Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, Braden and I are going to discuss a very big deal, or rather an event that's been overcome by a very big deal, the first Independence Day in South Dakota, and how that happened amidst an incredible flurry of exploration and diplomacy and cultural collision that occurred in South Dakota. So, Braden, thanks for helping me out on History 605 today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We started doing some digging several months ago about 4th of July's and how Independence Day has been celebrated. This, of course, is part of America 250 and our prep as the Historical Society. And from time to time, we've gotten questions from the public about what towns have done over the past. And so that had us do some digging, and I was able to find in a newspaper comment in the 1926, or the celebration in the marking of 150 years, that my predecessor had said that the first Independence Day celebration in South Dakota was done in 1825 at Fort Pierre. And that was quite an event and part and parcel of a larger expedition. I've done some digging on that, and due to the help of a number of different scholars and different books and photographs and even paintings, not particularly of that event, but of the people involved and the location involved, we've put together some notes, and we thought we would go ahead and do today's History 605 on this event in the ramp up for the coming July 4th and the 250th. Braden's dug into some things, and I've dug into some things, so hopefully this will be a great conversation. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think it ought to be. It's definitely an area of history that I think a lot of folks in our modern day don't know a lot about. You know, that early America, the 1820s, when it's really starting to get its footing, seems to be kind of understudied, at least in the modern day. So I think it'll be a good conversation.
Right. And I think setting up the pretext or the backstory to what's going on in July of 1825 in the United States is important because it really sets the scene for who the players are and where they're coming from. And hopefully we can understand a bit of that, or maybe more than a bit, as all the players involved and what were the motivations and what were they thinking when they were doing that. So certainly the exploration, when you first think of explorers, and as a recent podcast went into, the Lewis and Clark expedition comes through what is today South Dakota in 1804 and then back through in 1806. William Clark is made the governor of Missouri Territory, which at the time in 1806 up until 1820 was a vast expanse from that stretched from St. Louis to the Rocky Mountains in Montana. And that's a pretty broad area with lots of different things going on and a resource-rich region. What's the resource and what's the big business, Braden?
It is the fur trade.
There's
a high demand for furs from the North American continent heading back over to Europe.
Right. There has been a demand since the 1600s, and it's the reason why it's probably the prime motivator for a lot of the French exploration that goes on in North America, as well as some of the motivation for a lot of the English and Spanish motivation. And by the 1820s, beaver pelts in particular, but muskrats, other furs are huge business in Europe. Those guys in Paris want to wear their felt or their fur hats, not felt, their fur hats. And so it brings a lot of that there. And the way that the French would do this, and many of the British, and ultimately some of the American companies that get into the fur trade as well, would be they'd meet up with tribes in certain regions and conduct negotiations and set up a partnership in the, to use a Western term, they'd set up a partnership by which they would trade goods for the furs, and the warriors in the tribe would go out and hunt and bring back these fur to these rendezvous points, or these, some would become forts and some would just become locations on a map, and there would be an agreement in the certain times of year to show up and rendezvous, and then the French or the British trading companies would take the furs and off they would go down the Mississippi or down the Missouri or into the Great Lakes and off to Europe. And by the 1820s, 1 million pelts per year are taken from the Northern Plains. So this brings a lot of colorful characters to the Northern Plains. Guys like Jedediah Smith and Hugh Glass and Ashley and so forth.
It's interesting too, because the United States is slowly expanding. You know, we've just had the Louisiana Purchase, which has expanded the United States as part of the Lewis and Clark expedition. But that's also creating tensions between these new neighbors, particularly, you know, this is in the wake of the War of 1812. So tensions with the British are high. Mm-hmm. In fact, in 1823, Joshua Plitcher writes to Congress and he says, you know, the British are influencing the Indians out west to get them to raid our trading posts. And so he's pounding the table for more forts and military support to be in the west to help facilitate the protection of fur trappers and traders.
Well, and just to summarize that, there's a lot of different tribes in these regions. There's probably 20 or 30 different tribes in the Northern Plains. If you go from, say, Omaha or Council Bluffs up the Missouri River and up toward the Rockies or north toward the Canadian border. And that border, by the way, is kind of fuzzy. It's not a strict line as we would understand it today. The British and the United States have not yet drawn that line. Canada as an independent nation has not yet existed. It's still a larger part of the British Empire and the British Commonwealth. But there's a lot of, the border's pretty porous, I'll put it that way. And it's easily traveled across in this time frame. So, and then all the people groups that are there, the different tribes, they have different understandings and different agreements. And what might be, and it's important to point out too, what might be a business arrangement between, say, a fur trading company in London or Paris or Boston or Montreal is from the tribal perspective a familial one. It's a kinship right. relationship. They don't look at it that way. And so terminology that's used in a lot of these treaties doesn't quite mean the same thing that we would take it to mean. And there'll be more confusion of that, plenty of confusion of that for a couple hundred years in many respects. But more broadly speaking too, the War of 1812 you mentioned, and politics in the United States is really coming down along sectional lines. The issue of slavery we don't need to get into the Missouri Compromise, but a lot of the politics that's gone on is trying to kind of keep a lid on the growing concerns about how the United States will manage slavery as the expansion continues. And these are all, you know, fraught with all kinds of political questions. And the campaign of 1824, just to get closer to where we are, the main point of this podcast, 1824, the presidential election is a wild one. It's a crazy one. There's four candidates: John Quincy Adams, whose dad had been president; Andrew Jackson, who is in the minds of many Americans, single-handedly won the War of 1812.
Old Hickory.
Yeah. Old Hickory, right? A man from Georgia, Crawford, Secretary of State Crawford, and then an up-and-comer, Speaker of the House, Henry Clay. These three of these four will in their own respect, I guess each one of them dominate politics for a long time. Certainly Jackson will. But John Adams and in the Electoral College, Jackson, Adams, and Crawford get to go through to another round. There's no clear victory on Election Day. And so what happens when the Electoral College criteria is not met? Who decides who's going to be president?
Yeah, it goes to the U.S. House of Representatives and state delegations.
Yes.
So the states are each kind of picking out, all right, we want Jackson, we want Adams, we want Crawford.
So it gets thrown to the House and the state delegations. And, of course, the guy who comes in fourth is Henry Clay. But guess who's Speaker of the House? Henry Clay. So he's quickly becomes the kingmaker here. He bows out, and there's, as the election is buckling down and the House members and the state delegations are settling in and manage and count their votes and so forth, there's rumors going around that Adams and Clay have met and there's some deal going on. Nothing that's ever proven, and there's never any investigation, but the allegations are always there. And Jackson, of course, howls, because out of that House process, then John Quincy Adams is named President of the United States. He's the winner of the 1824 election. And Andrew Jackson, of course, he doesn't like this. He smells a rat. And so that will energize him to another run 4 years later. But in any event, for our purposes today, John Quincy Adams wins the election of 1824. Again, very close, largely along sectional lines, largely along many issues, primarily slavery. But one of the issues that everybody agrees upon, of course, they don't necessarily agree on how to resolve it, but is to how do we deal with the American Indian tribes as the nation expands west? Now, John Quincy Adams is now in the driver's seat on this, as in addition to Congress. And Congress has, in the preceding administration, voted to send an expedition up the Missouri to make friends and to sort out this. Because, again, the concerns about the Canadians and the British coming into what they view as American territory, into the Louisiana Purchase, and getting in the way of having this kind of first right of negotiation with the tribes.
There's also been conflict happening between these trappers and fur traders and the native tribes. Like the Ashley Party in 1823 ends up having 13 trappers get killed by the Arikara, and mm-hmm. it leads to a joint expedition with Leavenworth and the Lakota to attack the Arikara, which will become important later on. But there's constant little skirmishes and fighting, and it's not really clear who gets to insert their influence where. I mean, everyone's kind of jockeying for position out west, just like they are out east for the presidency.
Yeah, these fur traders, this is, of course, made somewhat famous in the recent movie, The Revenant, where a character, which is by... This is Hollywood again, run amok, but they did try to, when they've got the Rocky Mountains in the scene with Hugh Glass trying to make his way back after getting mauled by a bear, it's not historic. the scenery in there is great. It looks beautiful, but that's not what it looked like where Hugh Glass got mauled by the grizzly. However, I think the point you're making about that fighting, the Arikara War in 1823, this provides an interesting little insight into who's fighting the Arikara. It's the United States Army, and who else?
The Lakota.
Yes, there's elements of the Lakota that team up with the United States Army. And the Lakota and the Arikara have, over the decades prior to this, been enemies off and on. They have very different cultures. The Arikara tend to form cities, and at the time in 1823, they lived in three large villages across the river from what is today Mobridge. And so that's where there's, in the summer and fall of 1823, that's where these battles are. And the United States and the Lakota defeat the Arikara, and But the Lakota come away from that experience not all that impressed with the United States Army.
No, no. They, from their experience, they saw, you know, a smattering of artillery, and then it appeared that the U.S. troops just kind of ran away.
Yeah.
You know, they fired a few shots and ran away.
Honor, courage, and bravery is the utmost important to each individual Lakota man and woman, particularly in how they, how the warrior conducts themselves. They see some soldiers not behave that way, and that's what unimpresses them. Sure, the United States Army has lots of firepower, but just down to the individual soldier, it doesn't.
Right. What kind of warriors are these guys?
Right.
You know,
right.
Not impressed.
Not impressed. So all that is important because it comes into the factors about in July of 1825. So 2 years later, they get word that the come to a rendezvous at Fort Pierre to discuss a treaty. But before we get into that too much, let's talk about the expedition. Right. Who's the commander of this expedition that Congress funds?
Yep. The commander is going to be Brigadier General Henry Atkinson. He was in the 1821 Congress reduces the army. They're trying to make some budget cuts because in 1819, America has its first economic depression. It's the Panic of 1819. And there's a whole bunch of factors that go into that. But what's important is that America's going through an economic rough patch. Congress decides, well, we need to reduce the army. And it also leads to a restructure. Which has Atkinson, he gets put in charge of the right wing of the Western Department. They had an Eastern and a Western Department.
Mm-hmm.
Atkinson gets placed in charge of the right wing. And so he's been out here. He's been out in the West dealing with the different issues between Indians and trappers. Finally, they get the approval for this expedition. And so Atkinson is in charge, and he's also accompanied by Indian agent Benjamin O'Fallon.
An Irishman, right? And if you want to be concerned about the British, there's no better person than an Irish American to take care of the British. The potato famine is not yet going to happen, but the enmity between the Irish and the British is longstanding. So, O'Fallon is the Indian agent for the territory. And so the two are kind of a team as they go up with the charge now by newly elected President Adams to go up the Missouri, make friends, sign treaties. And these treaties are all about trade, and they're not about, you know, buying land at all. These treaties focus on the trade and trading rights. And so that's the impetus behind what they're going to do. And they're going to do it in boats that are very different in many respects from the Lewis and Clark rafts. Atkinson invents and has new vessels crafted for this very expedition. It's quite something, these wheel boats that he's got. But, you know, the Missouri River, she's pretty tough. And navigating up the river is a challenge, even in the best of conditions. The eddies, the currents, the branches, the trees, the debris that might be floating down in the summer, in the winter melt as it comes down the river. All these make things very hazardous and tricky to navigate up the river. So you really need to know what you're doing. And they set out from St. Louis and in 1824, and they only get as far as Council Bluffs. Lewis and Clark, by the end of navigating, by the time winter rolls in, they're all the way up in what is today Bismarck, North Dakota. So they had a heck of a time with their wheel boats. And of course, now they have, with these treaty making, there's an appropriation not only to pay for the expedition and supplies and so forth, but also for gifts to the Indians. Huh? What was that cost or that appropriation for gifts?
So in the bill that was signed on May 25th of 1824, the expedition was given $10,000 for their supplies. And then the quote is a similar amount.
Okay.
for gifts for the Native Americans. But that, I mean, what an amount for the time.
So it's got to fit on these boats somewhere, and the gifts would be finished goods, tools, knives, cooking
muskets, goods, powder, muskets, weapons, blankets. Yep. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Everything that you might you find handy.
Of. Right.
And they also plan on making gifts of horses. That's mm-hmm. interesting that they do that. So up the river they go, and they are able to start with the, on the 9th of June, they meet with the Ponca tribe at the mouth of White Paint Creek. This is not far from Council Bluffs. And they sign a treaty with the Ponca. Then they head further upriver. June 22nd, they sign a treaty with the Yankton and Yanktonai at Fort Lookout near Three Rivers. And this is the beginning of a meeting with Lakota, Dakota, the Ocheti Shakowi, this larger tribal group, form the basis of the next several stops. They conduct that at Fort Lookout. This is near probably Oklahoma, across the river from Chamberlain today,
mm-hmm.
Where that treaty is concluded. And that's on June 22nd. And then they head up the river from there, going to what they call Fort Pier, or sometimes alternately Fort Teton, or the Bad River, alternately the Teton River. Today we call it the Bad River, and it meets the Missouri where Fort Pier is today. And as they're leaving from signing the treaty with the Yankton, they send out word to the Sikonju and the Oglala and the Cheyenne that they will mm-hmm. would like to have a meeting and discussions and discuss a treaty where the Bad River meets the Missouri.
Yeah, you're starting to see, at this time of year, it would have been like your springtime, your early to mid-spring. The Oglala were in the Black Hills, wintering there. And so as they're starting to come together again to meet up and start doing their summer events, word gets out that there's going to be treaties that are going to be signed. And so they start making their way to the Bad River. On the way, you know, they're making buffalo hunts, they're amassing yep. meat, tongues, and skins for their different summits throughout the summer.
Right. And this is the normal course of events for them in the 18-teens, 20s, 30s, 40s would be to winter in and around the Black Hills for the Oglala, and other tribes in the Lakota spend time in the Black Hills in the winter. Then as spring comes and as summer comes, head out onto the plains west of the Missouri to hunt buffalo and to congregate, have the Sundance late June. And that's what they're doing when representatives come from Fort Pier to speak to them about the opportunity for this treaty. And we've found, by the courtesy of a British historian by the name of Kingsley Bray, who's written several articles about 18th century Lakota, and he's written a really fascinating biography of Crazy Horse. He has worked with a descendant of a tribal historian and winter count keeper and ledger keeper that's been handed down through the generations, and has written a couple of articles about that based on these winter counts and these memories that have been handed down to in this family.
Yeah, and the so, American horse preserved yeah, the by American horse ledger.
It's really insightful into the minds and the habits of the Oglala at this time. It's been quite handy. So it's been fascinating to get into this and see what they thought was occurring and their discussions and their motivations. So Braden, what was the first thing as you dive into this Oglala camp circle and the culture in 1825 and these different Teoshpes and different subgroups of the tribe, what strikes you?
It's complexity. I mean, yeah. It really is kind of amazing, the system that they had and how they chose the representatives. For this, they had a group of deciders, you know, mm-hmm. different warriors and chiefs who they felt would represent, you know, different familial bands or even and how they advocate for their different points of views. it was interesting to see the split inside the Oglala, as described by the American Horse Ledger, that there are some who said, hey, you know, this will be a wonderful opportunity for trade, kind of viewing it as, well, the Americans are here. We're not going to get away from them, so let's work with them, versus a group who highly valued their independence and really wanted little to do with that, and kind of the complex debate that they were having at the time internally.
You see this is a continuation of the debate that occurred when Lewis and Clark came, that when the, I suppose to some degree, the Verendrye brothers came even before Lewis and Clark, and that all of these fur traders are prompting them to have, but certainly now with the British out of the area, more or less, and the United States wanting to assert control of the area and acting like it has some control, the United States Army not impressing them. And, you know, it's kind of, when you think about the pluses and minuses of doing an agreement with the United States, there could be a wide variety of reactions to that. But again, their participation in the Arikara War, them seeing the United States Army, they might have, I guess, what we would call technology or something, these firearms, but the soldiers have a lot to be desired. And so that really weighs in too, and they don't know if they're getting, if how they should do it. So in their traditional longstanding ways, they meet up for these hunts and the Sundance, and the part of the Sundance negotiations or preceding the Sundance that occurs is these thinking about, well, how are we going to decide? And so they go through a process about.
Right. And the first question that they ask themselves is, should the Lakotas even approve the treaty? You know, I mean, they've been having this conversation, but also contact, as we said, for over two decades between just the Lakota and the United States. And so you get the Brule Division, because they're more south, you know, they had a lot more contact with St. Louis and the different traders. And it gets into the, Bray has a fantastic article where he kind of lays out the way that the treaty was understood. But in 1815, the Lakotas had signed an agreement promising peace, friendship, and trade. And part of that wasn't in the treaty, but was understood, was a commitment to keep the Missouri River open to trade boats. It's interesting to see the way that these agreements took shape and were influencing the current situation they found themselves in.
And 20 years later, you'll see the Oregon Trail in the 1840s starts an immigration path, and that changes the dynamic in a different way. But in this case, with the rivers, the Missouri in particular being the trade route, controlling that is something that the Lakota have been doing for about 20 years by this time, and that they seek to continue that. And so that's a part and parcel of their thinking as well.
There's an interesting line from the Bray article. He kind of runs over the, you know, the Brule and the Hunkpa divisions, and he gets to one point where they're kind of leaning towards yes, like we should mm-hmm. do that. But he says, as tribal historian Thomas American Horse observed to his grandson in the early 1960s, family attitudes to the white presence, attitudes which shaped the Sioux Wars era, were forged in 1825. Descendants of the skeptical of 1825 formed the core of Oglala armed resistance to the Americans a generation later. This meeting is really setting the seeds for the conflict or lack of conflict that you're going to see from different groups going forward.
It sets that stage between those who want to work out some kind of arrangement and those who want to stay completely independent. And so you'll see that kind of transpire into, you know, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull being the descendants of one idea, and others like Red Cloud, probably most famously, ultimately wanting to come to some kind of agreement or settlement. And neither way is without its peril, put it that way. So ultimately they select these four who are going to be the deciders. The deciders do determine that they would recommend that they sign the treaty. And then there's this interesting check or double decision or re-decision where they send it to an even a more elder group. And they
the
also
silent eaters.
The yeah. silent eaters, yes. These four men, the silent eaters, High Pine, Long Road, Warlance, and Eats from the Horn. They meditate on these issues over a feast and discuss things very intensely and seriously. And then ultimately they agree that okay, we should go ahead and sign the agreement. And then they also decide who's going to speak for them, which is another thing that is often misinterpreted by the Americans, is this: the person doing the speaking isn't the boss. He's just the one doing the speaking.
Right.
So for an American Army officer, that's often very hard to understand the distinction there. So a messenger is sent from Fort Pierre. Once the Atkinson's group gets to that area, it's sent out there. They find them about 2 miles west of modern-day Fort Pierre, down the Bad River Valley. And what was the number of teepees? 110? This is a major group of people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just, you know, 80 guys wandering around. It's
right.
Yeah, 110 lodges.
Right. So they're doing they complete the Sundance, they move 110, mm-hmm. but this is just of the Oglala.
Right. That's true.
The Cheyenne, so there's going to be more more Cheyenne coming, mm-hmm. More Northern Lakota. You're going to get quite a few people who end up at that Bad River, mouth of the Bad River area, who will be part of these treaty negotiations, as it were.
So when they do arrive, they start with kind of main discussions or initial discussions on July 3rd. And Atkinson informs them, well, tomorrow is a very special day for us. It's a festival day celebrating our separation from the British. And so we won't be having any serious discussions tomorrow, but we would invite you to participate in our Independence Day celebrations. So they do. Now, let's backtrack a little bit too and say, you know, the 4th of July itself has a history as a holiday, right? The first 4th of July, of course, wasn't known that anything had happened until the 8th of July. On the 3rd of July, 1776, John Adams famously says in a letter to his wife that this Independence Day, it ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance of solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade and shows and games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of the continent to the other, from this time forevermore. And he's writing that not about the Declaration of Independence, but about the vote they took on the 2nd of July to go ahead and declare independence. And then they meet on the 4th and approve the language of the Declaration. And so John Adams, who's still living in 1825, by the way, is in his home in Boston when all this is occurring in Fort Pierre. Early during the Revolution, communities would get together and celebrate the 4th of July with picnics and fireworks and so forth. And then in Congress, not until 1870, does Congress make the 4th of July a holiday. And of course, the federal government didn't have its reach that it does today, but it was I guess today we would say this is an unpaid holiday. It joins New Year's Day, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and I think Easter as federally recognized holiday. In 1876, the centennial is being marked locally, as well as a major celebration of the nation in Philadelphia. In 1926, the Susquehannock Centennial, the 150th, happens with a lot of federal and local activities. It's not until 1938 that Congress makes it a paid federal holiday that we would recognize today. And then in 1976, the bicentennial happens. And of course, this year, 2026, the semiquincentennial happens. And so in 1824, 1825, when this is occurring, the tradition that many Americans had would be local celebrations with fireworks and picnics and food and games and shows and readings of the Declaration and so forth that would occur. And so that's what Atkinson and Leavenworth is thinking of, that they have. And they invite the tribes to participate in this, and they do. They have horse races, games, they participate in this. They fire off the cannon, fireworks, and so they have what we would, in many respects, recognize as a 4th of July celebration with their new friends from the Oglala and Cheyenne tribes participate. I'd like to know who won the horse races. That would be an interesting thing. They don't comment on that. Neither one of them says the particulars, but it would be interesting to know who they did or yeah, who I'm won sure those games.
I'm sure they had a ball. And I know the soldiers were having a good time because Atkinson makes sure that each man gets issued an additional gill of whiskey for the day. So that's about 4 ounces. But
yep, federal funds for drinking.
Exactly.
He also, Atkinson has a newly promoted officer, a William Harney, who's a part of this expedition, read the Declaration of Independence during one of the ceremonial times on the 4th of July. And the Oglala are there to listen to the Declaration of Independence. I don't know how the translation of that would have worked. As I said in a previous episode, that translating the very complex ideas of the Declaration of Independence into foreign languages can be difficult to do. And Lakota, being such a language rich with symbolism and aphorisms and sayings that are only meaningful if you've kind of lived through what they're meant to represent, can be really tough. And of course, the Declaration of Independence is filled with those similar kinds of sayings that is imbued with a lot of meaning that only is probably the most riveting when you've lived through it, as some of these people would have done. So, well, 49 years after, there's not a lot of people around, but their grandfathers and fathers were, it means a lot to them. So anyway, I just can't quite picture, given what Harney ultimately does to later generations of the Lakota and Cheyenne, that here we have him in Fort Pierre on July 4th, 1825, reading the Declaration of Independence and them sitting there and listening. It's quite a picture.
It kind of makes you appreciate how quickly the rate of change happens in the 1800s and relationships and the migration westward, and how all those factors just kind of lead to almost a new place, a new setting by, you know, the 1860s, 1870s.
Right. Well, events matter. Well, so the next day then, on the 5th of July, they reconvene and kind of begin to go through the details of the treaty. And now, this is a treaty where, by and large, the deciders and the elders of the Oglala and the Cheyenne have since joined them. They get the gist of what the Sikonju and the Yankton have already signed, because they've heard via their networks from them the agreement. And so as they listen to this, they're checking that. But it's not something that they're not listening to it for the first time and then going away and deciding and coming back. They've heard the gist of the treaty. They've decided they're going to agree. And now they think they're largely doing something that's maybe in their minds viewed as ceremonial, but still necessary to proceed through this process. And so I think it'd be good, too, though, for the listeners to kind of go through what does the treaty actually say? Well, there's 6 articles to the treaty, and Article 1 asserts the supremacy of the United States and that the tribes should acknowledge that. This is where translation really matters, because if you put it in terms that recognize the kinship, like the Great Father terms, then the Lakota aren't recognizing the supremacy of the United States at all. They're just recognizing the obligations of the United States. There's a key distinction there that means quite a bit of difference. And then Article 2 says the United States will protect them from the British or the Spanish or other national powers. Article 3 sets up the places of where trade will occur. Article 4 regulates the trade among the Indians and asks the Indians to not make war on one another. Article 5, this is the, if there's injuries or if there's American soldiers or American citizens who misbehave, that there's an agreement about how they're going to prosecute them, and the tribes agree to prosecute or to deal with the discipline and nature of those who harm Americans. Article 6 is everyone's agreeing not to provide guns and firearms to the other tribes, that if the tribes want firearms, they should come to the United States, and that this is a way to kind of maintain the hostilities or to seek to control the hostilities within the borders of the United States. Ultimately, they sign this. The signatures are on the record as who signs for the tribes. And then it goes off to Washington, D.C., gets ratified by the Senate and signed by President Adams on February 6, 1826. After that occurs, the tribes disband, and the Atkinson expedition heads further up the river. On the 16th, they sign with elements of the Northern Lakota or the Hunkpapa. On the 18th, they sign with the Arikara tribe, which is still in the area, well, probably southern North Dakota, what is today southern North Dakota. The 30th, they sign with the Mandan. And on the 4th, they sign with the Crow. So they're reaching, getting toward eastern Montana by this point. Interesting comment. One of the signatures, though, is a man named Black Elk.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the famous Black Elk of Black Elk Speaks, but it is more than likely his grandfather. And right. He had come from an eminent family of holy men and spiritual leaders. And so Black Elk fell in that tradition within his family. And one of them is in these lists of those who signed the Treaty of 1825.
Yeah, it's interesting. There were three men who were really recognized as the principal chiefs for the Oglala signing of the treaty. That would have been Standing Bull, Charger, and the Cheyenne Highback Wolf. And so they all sign it, and they're in order of not necessarily seniority, but I think it was custom to let since the Oglala were hosting, the Northern Lakota got a sign, mm-hmm. then there was the Oglala, and then I believe the Cheyenne did on the 5th. But after they sign, and then on the 6th, the U.S. starts to, the army had brought all these gifts to hand out.
Yes.
They had brought 3 tons of gifts up the river, which I imagine probably helped to slow them down quite a bit. But they take some of the gifts out, they make 3 equal piles, and then they start giving it to these different groups. And like we said earlier, it was all kinds of items, you know, muskets and ammunition, powder, ball, blankets, lengths of cloth, scissors, needles, awls, colored beads, vermilion. Anything you could really think of were being distributed out. Even, and I think this is my favorite detail, 3 horses with holsters, pistols, and swords were presented by General Atkinson to the 3 principal chiefs. Mm-hmm. And so by 3 p.m., when they all begin heading homeward, Standing Bull and his peers are riding the large American horses and bearing their sabers as they had observed officers doing through the previous 5 days.
Right. Culturally, these are seen as, okay, you have presented us these gifts, you're meeting your obligation, and from the Lakota point of view, the gifts will keep coming. And of course, now they've got firearms and ammunition to keep participating in the buffalo trade and the fur trade more broadly. But by this time, by the 1830s and 1840s, there will be lots of robes, lots of buffalo robes heading down the river. And certainly it will pick up in the 1870s and 80s, almost certainly, unfortunately, so with the pace of that. Interestingly, General Atkinson, in his final report, after he's all done with this expedition, is going back. He makes a report to the president and to Congress formally that's in the record today, and you can read that. He says, first off, he goes down every point where they signed every treaty and who the people were, broadly speaking, and he says whether they're friendly or not. And he lists the Lakota as being friendly. Of course, he's just served with them in the Arikara War and then met, of course, with them. So he wouldn't necessarily have any reason not to say that, and he doesn't. He says that they're friendlies and that they mostly trade in robes. There's kind of a description there in his report about what they're mostly interested in providing, and it's clear that what they're providing now is not beaver pelts but buffalo robes. He also says building a fort up in the northern plains would be a waste of time. We can, because of these treaties and the agreements we have and our ability to get around to the sense that we need and the lack of settlers coming to the area, again, this is 1825, 1826, he sees no reason for a fort north of Council Bluffs.
Right. Well, and Atkinson, it was interesting, even when he first took the job in 1821, his recommendation was, we'll go up and do an expedition once a year, take 400 men, kind of show the colors around.
Yep.
And that's really all you need. The idea of keeping permanent garrisons in kind of these isolated areas was, he didn't think it was a very good idea at all.
Yeah.
Back then, and I think this expedition reinforced that for him.
And, of course, there's lots of schools of thought going on in the United States, too, about how to... In the move west, the question about how to deal with the tribes who were there is of preeminent importance. One major school of thought is that assimilation and inviting them in, make them farmers, give them all the equipment they need, and they can farm, and then they could be like us. It's interesting, though, John Quincy Adams, toward the end of his administration, is very skeptical of that view. In fact, he's come to the conclusion that setting out this type of assimilation policy is just a recipe for failure, and setting up these forts and so forth. And so I think as he enters the last bit, and ultimately he'll lose his reelection, but as he enters the last part of his four-year term, he's given up on the idea of that type of thing, and he's more along the lines of the other school of thought, which almost every president after him will share, in one way, shape, or form, is that we'll just need to skip that area and set up a large region for them to be and hold them separate. And then maybe over time, those regions or districts or whatever, or reservations will come in as separate states. In fact, President Grant ultimately tries to do this too. So it's interesting that after you walk down the path of these different options, both within the Lakota and what they think of the treaty and the United States and what they think of the treaty, they tend to learn from it, but then they're replaced.
Right.
And new people don't learn from the old people, which always gives us historians lots to do, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Well, and so that's the story of the first Independence Day celebrated in what is today South Dakota. And it has to do with these different cultures, lots of languages being spoken, Irish, British, American, Lakota, Cheyenne, politics, the geography, the topography, games, shows, bells, fireworks, and horse races, and the Declaration of Independence being read by William Harney, who will go on to infamy, and whose name will for a while be the name that connotes the highest peak east of the Rockies. But then, of course, in 2016, that name changes to Black Elk. Mm-hmm. And so Black Elk Peak has had two namesakes, and both of them have been part of this first 4th of July in South Dakota event.
It's kind of an amazing story. You don't realize, just how instrumental this event was in setting up the future of the Dakota, eventual Dakota territory and our state's history.
And it's easy to kind of skip over, right? In fact, I only kind of went down this rabbit hole because of the 250th celebration. So that, again, that's kind of another reason why we mark these occasions and think about them. Everything has a history, including the history of how the nation marks the Declaration of Independence and Independence Day and its birthday. So this was a welcome excursion down that. So thanks for helping me out, Braden. We hope you've enjoyed that.
Yeah, I absolutely did. It's, like I said earlier, eye-opening. It was really cool to dig into this research, and I would highly recommend people, if you want to learn more, look into Kingsley Bray. He has a wonderful article, The Oglala Lakota and the Atkinson-O'Fallon Treaty of 1825.
Yes.
He also has his book, Wheelboats on the Missouri, The Journals and Documents of the Atkinson-O'Fallon Expedition, 1824 to 1826.
Right. Well, Braden, thanks a lot for joining me on History 605, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, thank you.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.